Harlan waited to answer. He did not see where the conversation was aiming or what Senor's deeper purposes were, and it unnerved him. He said, "I don't know enough to answer you with certainty, sir. I believe there may have been speculations as to alternate paths of time or planes of existence. I don't know." Senor thrust out a lower lip.
"I'm sure you're wrong.
You may have been misled by reading your own knowledge into various ambiguities you may have come across. No, without actual experience of time travel, the philosophic intricacies of reality would be quite beyond the human mind. For instance, why does reality possess inertia? We all know that it does. Any alteration in its flow must reach a certain magnitude before a change, a true change, is effected. Even then, reality has a tendency to flow back to its original position. For instance, suppose a change here in the 575th. Reality will change with increasing effects to perhaps the 600th. It will change, but with continually lesser effects to perhaps the 650th. Thereafter, reality will be unchanged. We all know this is so, but do any of us know why it is so? Intuitive reasoning would suggest that any reality change would increase its effects without limit as the centuries pass, yet that is not so. Take another point. Technician Harlan, I'm told, is excellent at selecting the exact minimum change required for any situation. I'll wager he cannot explain how he arrives at his own choice. Consider how helpless the primitives must be. They worry about a man killing his own grandfather because they do not understand the truth about reality. Take a more likely and a more easily analyzed case, and let's consider the man who, in his travels through time, meets himself.
Harlan said sharply, "What about a man who meets himself?" The fact that Harlan interrupted a computer was a breach of manners in itself. His tone of voice worsened the breach to a scandalous extent, and all eyes turned reproachfully on the technician. Senor harrumphed, but spoke in the trained tone of one determined to be polite despite nearly insuperable difficulties. He said, continuing his broken sentence and thus avoiding the appearance of answering directly the unmannerly question addressed to him, "And the four subdivisions into which such an act can fall. Call the man earlier in physio time A, and the one later B, subdivision 1. A and B may not see one another, or do anything that will significantly affect one another. In that case, they have not really met, and we may dismiss this case as trivial. Or B, the later individual may see A, while A does not see B. Here too, no serious consequences need be expected. B seeing A sees him in a position and engaged in activity of which he already has knowledge. Nothing new is involved. The third and fourth possibilities are that A sees B while B does not see A, and that A and B see one another. In each possibility, the serious point is that A has seen B. The man at an earlier stage in his physiological existence sees himself at a later stage. Observe that he has learned he will be alive at the apparent age of B. He knows he will live long enough to perform the action he has witnessed. Now a man, in knowing his own future, in even the slightest detail, can act on that knowledge and therefore changes his future. It follows that reality must be changed to the extent of not allowing A and B to meet, or, at the very least, of preventing A from seeing B. Then, since nothing in a reality made unreal can be detected, A never has met B. Similarly, in every apparent paradox of time travel, reality always changes to avoid the paradox, and we come to the conclusion that there are no paradoxes in time travel and that there can be none.
Senor looked well pleased with himself and his exposition, but Twissel rose to his feet.
Twistle said,
I believe, gentlemen, that time presses.
Far more suddenly than Harlan would have thought, the lunch was over. Five of the subcommittee members filed out, nodding at him, with the air of those whose curiosity, mild at best, had been assuaged. Only Senor held out a hand and added a gruff,
Good day, young man,
to the nod. With mixed feelings, Harlan watched them go. What had been the purpose of the luncheon? Most of all, why the reference to men meeting themselves? They had made no mention of Noyes. Were they there, then, only to study him, survey him from top to bottom and leave him to Twistle's judging? Twistle returned to the table, empty now of food and cutlery. He was alone with Harlan now, and almost as though to symbolize that, he wielded a new cigarette between his fingers. He said,
And now to work, Harlan. We have a great deal to do.
But Harlan would not, could not, wait longer. He said flatly, Before we do anything, I have something to say. Twistle looked surprised. The skin of his face puckered up about his faded eyes, and he tamped at the ash end of his cigarette thoughtfully. He said,
By all means, speak if you wish, but first, sit down, boy.
Technician Andrew Harlan did not sit down. He strode up and back the length of the table, biting off his sentences hard to keep them from boiling and bubbling into incoherence. Senior computer Laban Twistle's age-yellowed pippin of a head turned back and forth as he followed the other's nervous stride. Harlan said, For weeks now I've been going through films on the history of mathematics, books from several realities of the 575th. The realities don't matter much. Mathematics doesn't change. The order of its development doesn't change either. No matter how else the realities shifted, mathematical history stayed about the same. The mathematicians changed. Different ones switched discoveries. But the end results... Anyway, I pounded a lot of it into my head. How does that strike you?
Twistle frowned and said, A queer occupation for a technician.
But I'm not just a technician, said Harlan. You know that.
Go on, said Twistle,
and he looked at the timepiece he wore. The fingers that held his cigarette played with it with unwanted nervousness. Harlan said, There was a man named Vicar Melanson who lived in the 24th century. That was part of the primitive era, you know. The thing he is known best for is the fact that he first successfully built a temporal field. That means, of course, that he invented eternity, since eternity is only one tremendous temporal field short-circuiting ordinary time and free of the limitations of ordinary time.
You were taught this as a cub boy.
But I was not taught that Vicar Melanson could not possibly have invented the temporal field in the 24th century. Nor could anyone have. The mathematical basis for it didn't exist. The fundamental Lefebvre equations did not exist. Nor could they exist until the researchers of Jan Verdier in the 27th century. If there was one sign by which Senior Computer Twistle could indicate complete astonishment, it was that of dropping his cigarette. He dropped it now. Even his smile was gone.
He said, Were you taught the Lefebvre equations, boy?
No, and I don't say I understand them. But they're necessary for the temporal field. I've learned that. And they weren't discovered till the 27th, I know that too. Twistle bent to pick up his cigarette and regarded it dubiously.
What if Melanson had stumbled on the temporal field without being aware of the mathematical justification? What if it were simply an empirical discovery? There have been many such.
I've thought of that. But after the field was invented, it took 3 centuries to work out its implications, and at the end of that time there was no one way in which Melanson's field could be improved on. That could not be coincidence. In 100 ways, Melanson's design showed that he must have used the Lefebvre equations. If he knew them, or had developed them without Verdier's work, which is impossible, why didn't he say so?
Twistle said, "You insist on talking like a mathematician. Who told you all this?"
"I've been viewing films."
"No more?"
"And thinking."
"Without advanced mathematical training? I've watched you closely for years, boy, and would not have guessed that particular talent of yours. Go on."
"Eternity could never have been established without Melanson's discovery of the temporal field. Melanson could never have accomplished this without a knowledge of mathematics that existed only in his future. That's number one. Meanwhile, here in eternity at this moment, there is a cub who was selected as an eternal against all the rules, since he was overage and married to boot. You are educating him in mathematics and in primitive sociology. That's number two."
"Well?"
"I say that it is your intention to send him back into time somehow, back past the down-when terminus of eternity, back to the 24th. It is your intention to have the cub, Cooper, teach the Lefebvre equations to Melanson. You see then," Harlan added with tense passion, "that my own position as expert in the primitive and my knowledge of that position entitles me to special treatment, very special treatment."
"Father Time,"
muttered Twistle. "It's true, isn't it? We come full circle. With my help. Without it." He let the sentence hang.
"You come so close to the truth," said Twistle. "Yet I could swear there was nothing to indicate."
He fell into a study in which neither Harlan nor the outside world seemed to play a part. Harlan said quickly, "Only close to the truth. It is the truth." He could not tell why he was so certain of the essentials of what he said, even quite apart from the fact that he so desperately wanted it to be so. Twistle said,
"No, no, not the exact truth. The cub, Cooper, is not going back to the 24th to teach Melanson anything."
"I don't believe you."
"But you must. You must see the importance of this. I want your cooperation through what is left of the project. You see, Harlan, the situation is more full circle than you imagine. Much more so, boy. Cub Brinsley Sheridan Cooper is Vicar Melanson."
Chapter 12. The Beginning of Eternity. Harlan would not have thought that Twistle could have said anything at that moment that could have surprised him. He was wrong. He said, "Melanson." Twistle, having smoked his cigarette to a stub, produced another and said,
"Yes, Melanson. Do you want a quick summary of Melanson's life? Here it is. He was born in the 78th, spent some time in eternity, and died in the 24th.
Twistle's small hand placed itself lightly on Harlan's elbow, and his gnomish face broke into a wrinkled extension of his usual smile.
"But come, boy. Physio-time passes even for us, and we are not completely masters of ourselves this day. Won't you come with me to my office?"
He led the way, and Harlan followed, not entirely aware of the opening doors and the moving ramps. He was relating the new information to his own problem and plan of action. With the passing of the first moment of disorientation, his resolution returned. After all, how did this change things except to make his own importance to eternity still more crucial, his value higher, his demands more sure to be met, Noyes more certain to be bartered back to him?
Noyes.
Father Time, they must not harm her. She seemed the only real part of his life. All eternity, beside, was only a filmy fantasy, and not a worthwhile one either. When he found himself in Computer Twistle's office, he could not clearly recall how it had come about that he had passed from the dining area here. Though he looked about and tried to make the office grow real by sheer force of the mass of its contents, it still seemed but another part of a dream that had outlived its usefulness. Twistle's office was a clean, long room of porcelain asepsis. One wall of the office was crowded from floor to ceiling and wall to distant wall with the computing micro-units which, together, made up the largest privately operated computerplex in Eternity, and indeed, one of the largest altogether. The opposite wall was crammed with reference films. Between the two, what was left of the room was scarcely more than a corridor, broken by a desk, two chairs, recording and projecting equipment, and an unusual object the like of which Harlan was not familiar with, and which did not reveal its use until Twistle flicked the remnants of a cigarette into it. It flashed, noiselessly, and Twistle, in his usual prestidigitational fashion, held another in his hands. Harlan thought, to the point now. He began, a trifle too loudly, a bit too truculently. There is a girl in the 482nd. Twistle frowned, waved one hand quickly as though brushing an unpleasant matter hastily to one side.
I know, I know. She will not be disturbed, nor you. All will be well, I will see to it.
Do you mean?
I tell you I know the story. If the matter has troubled you, it need trouble you no more.
Harlan stared at the old man, stupefied. Was this all? Though he had thought intently of the immensity of his power, he had not expected so clear a demonstration. But Twistle was talking again.
Let me tell you a story, he began,
with almost the tone he would have used in addressing a newly inducted cub.
I had not thought this would be necessary, and perhaps it still isn't. But your own researches and insight deserve it.
He stared at Harlan quizzically and said,
You know, I still can't quite believe that you worked this out on your own.
Then went on.
The man most of Eternity knows as Vicar Malanson left the record of his life behind him after he died. It was not quite a diary, not quite a biography. It was more of a guide. Bequeathed to the Eternals he knew would someday exist. It was enclosed in a volume of time stasis, which could be opened only by the computers of Eternity, and which therefore remained untouched for 3 centuries after his death, until Eternity was established and senior computer Henry Wadsman, the first of the great Eternals, opened it. The document has been passed along in strictest security since, along a line of senior computers ending with myself. It is referred to as the Malanson Memoir. The memoir tells the story of a man named Brinsley Sheridan Cooper, born in the 78th, inducted as a cub into Eternity at the age of 23, having been married for a little over a year, but having been, as yet, childless. Having entered Eternity, Cooper was trained in mathematics by a computer named Laban Twistle, and in primitive sociology by a technician named Andrew Harlan. After a thorough grounding in both disciplines and in such matters as temporal engineering as well, he was sent back to the 24th to teach certain necessary techniques to a primitive scientist named Vicar Malanson. Once having reached the 24th, he embarked first on a slow process of adjusting himself to the society. In this, he benefited a great deal from the training of technician Harlan and the detailed advice of computer Twistle, who seemed to have an uncanny insight into some of the problems he was to face. After the passage of 2 years, Cooper located one Vicar Malanson, an eccentric recluse in the California backwoods, relationless and friendless, but gifted with a daring and unconventional mind. Cooper made friends, slowly, acclimated the man to the thought of having met a traveler from the future still more slowly, and set about teaching the man the mathematics he must know. With the passage of time, Cooper adopted the other's habits, learned to shift for himself with the help of a clumsy diesel-oil-electric generator and with wired electrical appliances which freed them of dependence on power beams. But progress was slow, and Cooper found himself something less than a marvelous teacher.
Malanson grew morose and uncooperative, and then one day died, quite suddenly, in a fall down a canyon of the wild, mountainous country in which they lived. Cooper, after weeks of despair, with the ruin of his life work and, presumably, of all eternity staring him in the eye, decided on a desperate expedient. He did not report Malanson's death. Instead, he slowly took to building, out of the materials at hand, a temporal field. The details do not matter. He succeeded after mountains of drudgery and improvisation and took the generator to the California Institute of Technology just as years before he had expected the real Malanson to do. You know the story from your own studies. You know of the disbelief and rebuffs he first met, his period under observation, his escape and the near loss of his generator, the help he received from the man at the lunch counter whose name he never learned, but who is now one of eternity's heroes, and of the final demonstration for Professor Zimbalist, in which a white mouse moved backward and forward in time. I won't bore you with any of that. Cooper used the name of Vicar Malanson in all this because it gave him a background and made him an authentic product of the 24th. The body of the real Malanson was never recovered. In the remainder of his life, he cherished his generator and cooperated with the Institute scientists in duplicating it. He dared do no more than that. He could not teach them the Lefebvre equations without outlining 3 centuries of mathematical development that was to come. He could not, dared not, hint at his true origin. He dared not do more than the real Vicar Malanson had, to his knowledge, done. The men who worked with him were frustrated to find a man who could perform so brilliantly and yet was unable to explain the whys of his performance. And he himself was frustrated too because he foresaw without in any way being able to quicken the work that would lead, step by step, to the classic experiments of Jan Verdier, and how from that the great Antoine Lefebvre would construct the basic equations of reality, and how after that eternity would be constructed. It was only toward the end of his long life that Cooper, staring into a Pacific sunset, he describes the scene in some detail in his memoir, came to the great realization that he was Vicar Malanson. He was not a substitute, but the man himself. The name might not be his, but the man history called Malanson was really Brinsley Sheridan Cooper. Fired with that thought, and with all that implied, anxious that the process of establishing eternity be somehow quickened, improved, and made more secure, he wrote his memoir and placed it in a tube of time stasis in the living room of his house. And so the circle was closed. Cooper Malanson's intentions in writing the memoir were, of course, disregarded. Cooper must go through his life exactly as he had gone through it. Primitive reality allows of no changes. At this moment in physio-time, the Cooper you know is unaware of what lies ahead of him. He believes he is only to instruct Malanson and to return. He will continue to believe so until the years teach him differently and he sits down to write his memoir. The intention of the circle in time is to establish the knowledge of time travel and of the nature of reality. To build eternity ahead of its natural time. Left to itself, mankind would not have learned the truth about time before their technological advances in other directions had more racial suicide inevitable. Harlan listened intently, caught up in the vision of a mighty circle in time, closed upon itself, and traversing eternity in part of its course. He came as close to forgetting Noyes, for the moment, as he ever could. He asked, "Then you knew all along everything you were to do, everything I was to do, everything I have done." Twistle, who seemed lost in his own telling of the tale, his eyes peering through a haze of bluish tobacco smoke,
came slowly to life. His old, wise eyes fixed themselves on Harlan, and he said reproachfully,
"No, of course not. There was a lapse of decades of physio time between Cooper's stay in Eternity and the moment when he wrote his memoir. He could remember only so much and only what he himself had witnessed. You should realize that."
Twistle sighed and he drew a gnarled finger through a line of updrafting smoke, breaking it into little, turbulent swirls.
"It worked itself out. First I was found and brought to Eternity. When, in the fullness of physio time, I became a senior computer, I was given the memoir and placed in charge. I had been described as in charge, so I was placed in charge. Again, in the fullness of physio time, you appeared in the changing of a reality. We had watched your earlier analogues carefully, and then Cooper. I filled in the details by using my common sense and the services of the computerplex. How carefully, for instance, we instructed Educator Yarrow in his part while betraying none of the significant truth. How carefully, in his turn, he stimulated your interest in the primitive. How carefully we had had to keep Cooper from learning anything he did not prove he had learned by reference in the memoir."
Twistle smiled sadly.
"Senor amuses himself with matters such as this. He calls it the reversal of cause and effect. Knowing the effect, one adjusts the cause. Fortunately, I am not the cobweb spinner Senor is. I was pleased, boy, to find you so excellent an observer and technician. The memoir had not mentioned that since Cooper had no opportunity to observe your work or evaluate it. This suited me. I could use you in a more ordinary task that would make your essential one less noticeable. Even your recent stay with Computer Finge fitted in. Cooper mentioned a period of your absence during which his mathematical studies were so sharpened that he longed for your return. Once, though, you frightened me."
Harlan said at once, "You mean the time I took Cooper along the Kettleways?"
"How do you come to guess that?"
demanded Twistle. "It was the one time you were really angry with me. I suppose now it went against something in the Melanson memoir."
"Not quite. It was just that the memoir did not speak of the kettles. It seemed to me that to avoid mention of such an outstanding aspect of Eternity meant he had little experience with it. It was my intention, therefore, to keep him away from the kettles as much as possible. The fact that you had taken him up when in one disturbed me greatly, but nothing happened afterward. Things continued as they should, so all is well."
The old computer rubbed one hand slowly over the other, staring at the young technician with a look compounded of surprise and curiosity.
"And all along you've been guessing this. It simply astonishes me. I would have sworn that even a fully trained computer could not have made the proper deductions given only the information you had. For a technician to do it is uncanny."
He leaned forward, tapped Harlan's knee lightly.
"The Melanson memoir says nothing about your life after Cooper's leaving, of course."
"I understand, sir," said Harlan.
"We will be free, then, in a manner of speaking, to do as we please with it. You show a surprising talent that must not be wasted. I think you are meant for something more than a technician. I promise nothing now, but I presume that you realize that computership is a distinct possibility."
It was easy for Harlan to keep his dark face expressionless. He had had years of practice for that. He thought, an additional bribe. But nothing must be left to conjecture. His guesses, wild and unsupported at the start, arrived at by a freak of insight in the course of a very unusual and stimulating night, had become reasonable as the result of directed library research. They had become certainties now that Twistle had told him the story. Yet, in one way, at least, there had been a deviation. Cooper was Melanson. That had simply improved his position, but wrong in one respect, he might be wrong in another. He must leave nothing to chance then. Have it out. Make certain. He said, levelly, almost casually, "The responsibility is great for me also, now that I know the truth."
"Yes, indeed."
"How fragile is the situation? Suppose something unexpected were to happen and I were to miss a day when I ought to have been teaching Cooper something vital."
"I don't understand you."
Was it Harlan's imagination, or had a spark of alarm sprung to life in those old, tired eyes? "I mean, can the circle break? Let me put it this way. If an unexpected blow on the head puts me out of action at a time when the memoir distinctly states I am well and active, is the whole scheme disrupted? Or suppose, for some reason, I deliberately choose not to follow the memoir, what then?"
"But what puts all this in your mind?"
"It seems a logical thought. It seems to me that, by a careless or willful action, I could break the circle and, well, what, destroy eternity?" "It seems so. If it is so," Harlan added composedly, "I ought to be told, so that I may be careful to do nothing unfitting, though I imagine it would take a rather unusual circumstance to drive me to such a thing." Twistle laughed, but the laughter rang false and empty in Harlan's ear.
"This is all purely academic, my boy. Nothing of this will happen, since it hasn't happened. The full circle will not break."
"It might," said Harlan. "The girl of the 482nd
is safe," said Twistle.
He rose impatiently.
"There's no end to this kind of talk, and I have quite enough of logic chopping from the rest of the subcommittee in charge of the project. Meanwhile, I have yet to tell you what I originally called you here to hear, and physio time is still passing. Will you come with me?"
Harlan was satisfied. The situation was clear, and his power unmistakable. Twistle knew that Harlan could say at will, "I will no longer have anything to do with Cooper." Twistle knew Harlan could at any moment destroy eternity by giving Cooper significant information concerning the memoir. Harlan had known enough to do this yesterday. Twistle had thought to overwhelm him with the knowledge of the importance of his task. But if the computer had thought to force Harlan into line in that way, he was mistaken. Harlan had made his threat very clear with respect to Noyes's safety, and Twistle's expression, as he had barked, "is safe," showed he realized the nature of the threat. Harlan rose and followed Twistle. Harlan had never been in the room they now entered. It was large and looked as though walls had been knocked down for its sake. It had been entered through a narrow corridor, which had been blocked off by a force screen that did not go down until after a pause sufficient for Twistle's face to be scanned thoroughly by automatic machinery. The largest part of the room was filled by a sphere that reached nearly to the ceiling. A door was open, showing four small steps leading to a well-lit platform within. Voices sounded from inside, and even as Harlan watched, legs appeared in the opening and descended the steps. A man emerged, and another pair of legs appeared behind him. It was Senor of the All-Wen Council, and behind him was another of the group at the breakfast table. Twistle did not look pleased at this. His voice, however, was restrained.
"Is the subcommittee still here?"
"Only we two," said Senor casually. "Rice and myself. A beautiful instrument we have here. It has the level of complexity of a spaceship."
Rice was a paunchy man with the perplexed look of one who is accustomed to being right, yet finds himself unaccountably on the losing side of an argument. He rubbed his bulbous nose and said,
"Senor's mind is running on space travel lately."
Senor's bald head glistened in the light.
"It's a neat point, Twistle," he said. "I put it to you. Is space travel a positive factor or a negative factor in the calculus of reality?"
"The question is meaningless," said Twistle impatiently. What type of space travel in what society, under what circumstances?
Oh, come. Surely there's something to be said concerning space travel in the abstract.
Only that it is self-limiting, that it exhausts itself and dies out.
Then it is useless, said Senor, with satisfaction, and therefore it is a negative factor. My view entirely.
If you please, said Twistle, Cooper will be here soon. We will need the floor clear.
By all means.
Senor hooked an arm under that of Rice and led him away. His voice declaimed clearly as they departed.
Periodically, my dear Rice, all the mental effort of mankind is concentrated on space travel, which is doomed to a frustrated end by the nature of things. I would set up the matrices except that I am certain this is obvious to you. With minds concentrated on space, there is neglect of the proper development of things earthly. I am preparing a thesis now for submission to the Council, recommending that realities be changed to eliminate all space travel errors as a matter of course.
Rice's treble sounded.
But you can't be that drastic. Space travel is a valuable safety valve in some civilizations. Take Reality 54 of the 290th, which I happen to recall offhand. Now there!
The voices cut off, and Twistle said,
A strange man, Senor. Intellectually, he's worth two of any of the rest of us, but his worth is lost in leapfrog enthusiasms.
Harlan said, Do you suppose he can be right? About space travel, I mean.
I doubt it. We'd have a better chance of judging if Senor would actually submit the thesis he mentioned, but he won't. He'll have a new enthusiasm before he's finished and drop the old. But never mind.
He brought the flat of his hand against the sphere so that it rang resoundingly, then brought his hand back so that he could remove a cigarette from his lip. He said,
Can you guess what this is, technician?
Harlan said, It looks like an outsized kettle with a top.
Exactly. You're right. You've got it. Come on inside.
Harlan followed Twistle into the sphere. It was large enough to hold four or five men, but the interior was absolutely featureless. The floor was smooth. The curved wall was broken by two windows. That was all. No controls? Asked Harlan.
Remote controls, said Twistle.
He ran his hand over the smoothness of the wall and said,
Double walls. The entire interwall volume is given over to a self-contained temporal field. This instrument is a kettle that is not restricted to the kettle shafts but can pass beyond the downwhen terminus of eternity. Its design and construction were made possible by valuable hints in the Melanson memoir. Come with me.
The control room was a cut-off corner of the large room. Harlan stepped in and stared somberly at immense bus bars.
Twistle said, Can you hear me, boy?
Harlan started and looked about. He had not been aware that Twistle had not followed him inside. He stepped automatically to the window, and Twistle waved to him. Harlan said,
I can hear you, sir. Do you want me outside?
Not at all. You are locked in.
Harlan sprang to the door and his stomach turned into a series of cold, wet knots. Twistle was correct, and what in time was going on?
Twistle said, You will be relieved to know, boy, that your responsibility is over. You were worried about that responsibility. You asked searching questions about it, and I think I know what you meant. This should not be your responsibility. It is mine alone. Unfortunately, we must have you in the control room since it is stated that you were there and handled the controls. It is stated in the Melanson memoir. Cooper will see you through the window, and that will take care of that. Furthermore, I will ask you to make the final contact according to instructions I will give you. If you feel that that too is too great a responsibility, you may relax. Another contact in parallel with yours is in charge of another man. If, for any reason, you are unable to operate the contact, he will do so. Furthermore,
I will cut off radio transmission from within the control room. You will be able to hear us, but not to speak to us. You need not fear, therefore, that some involuntary exclamation from you will break the circle."
Harlan stared, helplessly, out the window. Twistle went on.
"Cooper will be here in moments, and his trip to the primitive will take place within 2 physio hours. After that, boy, the project will be over, and you and I will be free."
Harlan was plunging chokingly through the vortex of a waking nightmare. Had Twistle tricked him? Had everything he had done been designed only to get Harlan quietly into a locked control room? Having learned that Harlan knew his own importance, had he improvised with diabolical cleverness, keeping him engaged in conversation, drugging his emotions with words, leading him here, leading him there, until the time was ripe for locking him in? That quick and easy surrender over Noyes. "She won't be hurt," Twistle had said. "All will be well." How could he have believed that? If they were not going to harm her or touch her, why the temporal barrier across the Kettleways at the 100,000th? That alone should have given Twistle completely away. But because he, fool, wanted to believe, he allowed himself to be led through those last physio hours blindly, placed inside a locked room where he was no longer needed, even to close the final contact. In one stroke, he had been robbed of his essentiality. The trumps in his hand had been neatly maneuvered into deuces, and Noyes was out of his reach forever. What punishment might lie in wait for him did not concern him. Noyes was out of his reach forever. It had never occurred to him that the project would be so close to its end. That, of course, was what had really made his defeat possible. Twistle's voice sounded dimly.
"You'll be cut off now, boy."
Harlan was alone, helpless, useless. Chapter 13. Beyond the Down When Terminus. Brinsley Cooper entered. Excitement flushed his thin face and made it almost youthful, despite the heavy Melanson mustache that draped its upper lip. Harlan could see him through the window, hear him clearly over the room's radio. He thought bitterly, "A Melanson mustache, of course." Cooper strode toward Twistle.
"They wouldn't let me in till now, computer."
"Very right," said Twistle. "They had their instructions.
Now's the time, though? I'll be heading out?"
"Almost the time."
"And I'll be coming back? I'll be seeing Eternity again?"
Despite the straightness Cooper gave his back, there was an edge of uncertainty in his voice. Within the control room, Harlan brought his clenched hands bitterly to the reinforced glass of the window, longing to break through somehow, to shout, "Stop it! Meet my terms or I'll—" What was the use? Cooper looked about the room, apparently unaware that Twistle had refrained from answering his question. His glance fell on Harlan at the control room window. He waved his hand excitedly.
"Technician Harlan, come on out. I want to shake your hand before I go."
Twistle interposed.
"Not now, boy, not now. He's at the controls."
Cooper said,
"Oh? You know, he doesn't look well."
Twistle said,
"I've been telling him the true nature of the project. I'm afraid that's enough to make anyone nervous."
Cooper said,
"Great time, yes. I've known about it for weeks now, and I'm not used to it yet."
There was a trace of near hysteria in his laugh.
"I still haven't got it through my thick head that it is really my show. I'm a little scared."
"I scarcely blame you for that.
It's my stomach mostly, you know. It's the least happy part of me."
Twistle said,
"Well, it's very natural, and it will pass. Meanwhile, your time of departure on Standard Intertemporal has been set, and there is still a certain amount of orientation to be gone through. For instance, you haven't actually seen the kettle you will use."
In the 2 hours that passed, Harlan heard it all, whether they were in sight or not. Twistle lectured Cooper in an oddly stilted manner, and Harlan knew the reason. Cooper was being informed of just those things that he was to mention in Melanson's memoir.
Full circle. Full circle.
And no way for Harlan to break that circle in one last defiant Samson smash of the temple. Round and round the circle goes, round and round it goes.
"Ordinary kettles," he heard Twistle say, "are both pushed and pulled. If we can use such terms in the case of intertemporal forces, in traveling from century X to century Y, within eternity there is a fully powered initial point and a fully powered final point. What we have here is a kettle with a powered initial point, but an unpowered destination point. It can only be pushed, not pulled. For that reason, it must utilize energies at a level whole orders of magnitude higher than those used by ordinary kettles. Special power transfer units have had to be laid down along the kettleways to siphon in sufficient concentrations of energy from Nova Sol. This special kettle, its controls and power supply, are a composite structure. For physio decades, the passing realities have been combed for special alloys and special techniques. The 13th reality of the 222nd was the key. It developed the temporal pressor, and without that, this kettle could not have been built. The 13th reality of the 222nd.
He pronounced that with elaborate distinctness. Harlan thought, "Remember that, Cooper. Remember the 13th reality of the 222nd, so you can put it into the Melanson memoir, so that the Eternals will know where to look, so they will know what to tell you, so you can put it..."
Round and round the circle goes.
Twistle said, "The kettle has not been tested past the downwind terminus, of course, but it has taken numerous trips within eternity. We are convinced there will be no bad effects."
"There can't be, can there?" said Cooper.
"I mean, I did get there, or Melanson could not have succeeded in building the field, and he did succeed."
Twistle said, "Exactly. You will find yourself in a protected and isolated spot in the sparsely populated southwestern area of the United States of America."
"America," corrected Cooper.
"America, then. The century will be the 24th, or, to put it to nearest hundredth, the 23rd.17th. I suppose we can even call it the year 2317, if we wish. The kettle, as you saw, is large, much larger than necessary for you. It is being filled now with food, water, and the means of shelter and defense. You will have detailed instructions that will, of course, be meaningless to anyone but you. I must impress upon you now that your first task will be to make certain that none of the indigenous inhabitants discovers you before you are ready for them. You will have force diggers with which you will be able to burrow well into a mountain to form a cache. You will have to remove the contents of the kettle rapidly. They will be stacked so as to facilitate that."
Harlan thought, "Repeat, repeat. He must have been told all this before, but repeat what must go into the memoir,
round and round."
Twistle said, "You will have to unload in 15 minutes. After that, the kettle will return automatically to starting point, carrying with it all tools that are too advanced for the century. You will have a list of those. After the kettle returns, you will be on your own."
Cooper said, "Must the kettle return so quickly?"
Twistle said, "A quick return increases the probabilities of success."
Harlan thought, "The kettle must return in 15 minutes, because it did return in 15 minutes. Round and..."
Twistle hurried on.
"We cannot attempt to counterfeit their medium of exchange of any of their negotiable scrip. You will have gold in the form of small nuggets. You will be able to explain its possession according to your detailed instructions. You will have native clothing to wear, or at least clothing that will pass for native."
"Right," said Cooper.
"Now remember, move slowly. Take weeks if necessary. Work your way into the era, spiritually. Technician Harlan's instructions are a good basis, but they are not enough.
You will have a wireless receiver built on the principles of the 24th, which will enable you to come abreast of the current events and, more important, learn the proper pronunciation and intonation of the language of the times. Do that thoroughly. I'm sure that Harlan's knowledge of English is excellent, but nothing can substitute for native pronunciation on the spot.
Cooper said, "What if I don't end up in the right spot? I mean, not in the 23rd.17.
Check on that very carefully, of course. But it will be right. It will be right."
Harlan thought, "It will be right, because it was right. Round." Cooper must have looked unconvinced, though, for Twistle said,
"The accuracy of focus was carefully worked out. I intended to explain our methods, and now is a good time. For one thing, it will help Harlan understand the controls."
Suddenly, Harlan turned away from the windows and fixed his gaze on the controls. A corner of the curtain of despair lifted. What if? Twistle still lectured Cooper with the anxious, overprecise tone of the schoolteacher, and with part of his mind, Harlan still listened. Twistle said,
"Obviously, a serious problem was that of determining how far into the primitive an object is sent after the application of a given energy thrust. The most direct method would have been to send a man into the downwind via this kettle using carefully graduated thrust levels. To do that, however, would have meant a certain lapse of time in each case while the man determined the century to its nearest hundredth through astronomical observation, or by obtaining appropriate information over the wireless. That would be slow, and also dangerous, since the man might well be discovered by the native inhabitants, with probably catastrophic effects on our project. What we did then instead was this. We sent back a known mass of the radioactive isotope, niobium-94, which decays by beta particle emission to the stable isotope, molybdenum-94. The process has a half-life of almost exactly 500 centuries. The original radiation intensity of the mass was known. That intensity decreases with time according to the simple relationship involved in first-order kinetics, and, of course, the intensity can be measured with great precision. When the kettle reaches its destination in primitive times, the ampule containing the isotope is discharged into the mountainside, and the kettle then returns to eternity. At the moment in physio-time that the ampule is discharged, it simultaneously appears at all future times growing progressively older. At the place of discharge in the 575th, in actual time and not in eternity, a technician detects the ampule by its radiation and retrieves it. The radiation intensity is measured. The time it has remained in the mountainside is then known. The century to which the kettle traveled is also known to two decimal places. Dozens of ampules were then sent back at various thrust levels, and a calibration curve set up. The curve was a check against ampules sent not all the way into the primitive, but into the early centuries of eternity, where direct observations could also be made. Naturally, there were failures. The first few ampules were lost until we learned to allow for the not too major geological changes between the late primitive and the 575th. Then, three of the ampules later on never showed up in the 575th. Presumably, something went wrong with the discharge mechanism, and they were buried too deeply in the mountain for detection. We stopped our experiments when the level of radiation grew so high that we feared that some of the primitive inhabitants might detect and wonder what radioactive artifacts might be doing in the region. But we had enough for our purposes, and we are certain we can send back a man to any hundredth of a century of the primitive that is desired. You follow all this, Cooper, don't you?
Cooper said, "Perfectly, Computer Twistle. I have seen the calibration curve without understanding the purpose at the time. It is quite clear now." But Harlan was exceedingly interested now. He stared at the measured arc marked off in centuries. The shining arc was porcelain on metal, and the fine lines divided it into centuries, decicenturies, and centicenturies.
Silvery metal gleamed thinly through the porcelain-penetrating lines, marking them clearly. The figures were as finely done, and, bending close, Harlan could make out the centuries from 17 to 27. The hairline was fixed at the 23rd.17th century mark. He had seen similar time gauges, and almost automatically he reached to the pressure control lever. It did not respond to his grasp. The hairline remained in place. He nearly jumped when Twistle's voice suddenly addressed him.
"Technician Harlan!"
he cried.
"Yes, computer."
Then remembered that he could not be heard. He stepped to the window and nodded. Twistle said, almost as though chiming in with Harlan's thoughts,
"The time gauge is set for a thrust back to the 23rd.17th. That requires no adjustment. Your only task is to pour energy through at the proper moment in physio time. There is a chronometer to the right of the gauge. Nod if you see it."
Harlan nodded. "It will reach 0 point backward. At the minus 15-second point, align the contact points. It's simple. You see how?" Harlan nodded again. Twistle went on. "Synchronization is not vital. You can do it at minus 14 or 13 or even minus 5 seconds, but please make every effort to stay this side of minus 10 for safety's sake. Once you've closed contact, a synchronized force gear will do the rest and make certain that the final energy thrust will occur precisely at time zero. Understood?"
Harlan nodded still again. He understood more than Twistle said. If he himself did not align the points by minus 10, it would be taken care of from without. Harlan thought grimly, "There'll be no need for outsiders." Twistle said,
"We have 30 physio minutes left. Cooper and I will leave to check on the supplies."
They left. The door closed behind them, and Harlan was left alone with the thrust control, the time already moving slowly backward toward zero, and a resolute knowledge of what must be done. Harlan turned away from the window. He put his hand inside his pocket and half withdrew the neuronic whip it still contained. Through all this he had kept the whip. His hand shook a little. An earlier thought recurred, a Samson smash of the temple. A corner of his mind wondered sickly, how many Eternals have ever heard of Samson? How many know how he died? There were only 25 minutes left. He was not certain how long the operation would take. He was not really certain it would work at all. But what choice had he? His damp fingers almost dropped the weapon before he succeeded in unhinging the butt. He worked rapidly and in complete absorption. Of all the aspects of what he planned, the possibility of his own passage into non-existence occupied his mind the least and bothered him not at all. At minus 1 minute, Harlan was standing at the controls. Detachedly, he thought, the last minute of life. Nothing in the room was visible to him but the backward sweep of the red hairline that marked the passing seconds. Minus 30 seconds. He thought, "It will not hurt. It is not death." He tried to think only of Noyes. Minus 15 seconds. Noyes. Harlan's left hand moved a switch down toward contact. Not hastily. Minus 12 seconds. Contact. The force gear would take over now. Thrust would come at zero time. And that left Harlan one last manipulation. The Samson smash. His right hand moved. He did not look at his right hand. Minus 5 seconds. Noyes. His right hand moved again, spasmodically. He did not look at it. Was this non-existence? Not yet. Non-existence, not yet. Harlan stared out the window. He did not move. Time passed, and he was unaware of its passage. The room was empty. Where the giant enclosed kettle had been was nothing. Metal blocks that had served as its base sat emptily, lifting their huge strength against air. Twistle, strangely small and dwarfed in the room that had become a waiting cavern, was the only thing that moved as he tramped edgily this way and that. Harlan's eyes followed him for a moment and then left him. Then, without any sound or stir, the kettle was back in the spot it had left. Its passage across the hairline from time past to time present did not as much as disturb a molecule of air. Twistle was hidden from Harlan's eyes by the bulk of the kettle, but then he rounded it, came into view. He was running. A flick of his hand was enough to activate the mechanism that opened the door of the control room. He hurtled inside, shouting with an almost lyrical excitement, "It's done! It's done! We've closed the circle!" He had breath to say no more. Harlan made no answer. Twistle stared out the window, his hands flat against the glass. Harlan noted the blotches of age upon them and the way in which they trembled. It was as though his mind no longer had the ability or the strength to filter the important from the inconsequential, but were selecting observational material in a purely random manner. Wearily, he thought, "What does it matter? What does anything matter now?" Twistle said, Harlan heard him dimly, "I'll tell you now that I've been more anxious than I cared to admit. Senor used to say once that this whole thing was impossible. He insisted something must happen to stop it. What's the matter?" He had turned at Harlan's odd grunt. Harlan shook his head, managed a choked, "Nothing." Twistle left it at that and turned away. It was doubtful whether he spoke to Harlan or to the air. It was as though he were allowing years of pent-up anxieties to escape in words. "Senor," he said, "was the doubter. We reasoned with him and argued. We used mathematics and presented the results of generations of research that had preceded us in the physio-time of eternity. He put it all to one side and presented his case by quoting the man meets himself paradox. You heard him talk about it. It's his favorite. We knew our own future," Senor said. "I, Twistle, knew, for instance, that I would survive despite the fact that I would be quite old until Cooper made his trip past the downwind terminus. I knew other details of my future, the things I would do. Impossible, he would say. Reality must change to correct your knowledge, even if it meant the circle would never close and eternity never established. Why he argued so, I don't know. Perhaps he honestly believed it. Perhaps it was an intellectual game with him. Perhaps it was just the desire to shock the rest of us with an unpopular viewpoint. In any case, the project proceeded, and some of the memoir began to be fulfilled. We located Cooper, for instance, in the century and reality that the memoir gave us. Senor's case was exploded by that alone, but it didn't bother him. By that time, he had grown interested in something else. And yet,
he laughed, gently, with more than a trace of embarrassment, and let his cigarette, unnoticed, burn down nearly to his fingers.
"You know, I was never quite easy in my mind. Something might happen. The reality in which eternity was established might change in some way in order to prevent what Senor called a paradox. It would have to change to one in which eternity would not exist. Sometimes, in the dark of a sleeping period when I couldn't sleep, I could almost persuade myself that that was indeed so, and now it's all over, and I laugh at myself as a senile fool."
Harlan said in a low voice, "Computer Senor was right." Twistle whirled.
"What?"
"The project failed." Harlan's mind was coming out of the shadows. Why and into what, he was not sure. "The circle is not complete."
"What are you talking about?"
Twistle's old hands fell on Harlan's shoulders with surprising strength.
You're ill, boy. The strain.
Not ill. Sick of everything.
You. Me.
Not ill.
The gauge.
See for yourself.
The gauge?
The hairline on the gauge stood at the 27th century, hard against the right-hand extreme.
What happened?
The joy was gone from his face. Horror replaced it. Harlan grew matter-of-fact. I melted the locking mechanism, freed the thrust control.
How could you?
I had a neuronic whip. I broke it open and used its micropile energy source in one flash like a torch. There's what's left of it. He kicked at a small heap of metal fragments in one corner. Twistle wasn't taking it in.
In the 27th? You mean Cooper's in the 27th?
I don't know where he is, said Harlan dully. I shifted the thrust control down when, further down than the 24th. I don't know where. I didn't look. Then I brought it back. I still didn't look. Twistle stared at him, his face a pale, unhealthy yellowish color, his lower lip trembling. I don't know where he is now, said Harlan. He's lost in the primitive.
The circle is broken.
I thought everything would end when I made the stroke, at zero time.
That's silly.
We've got to wait. There'll be a moment in physio time when Cooper will realize he's in the wrong century, when he'll do something against the memoir, when he broke off, then broke into a forced and creaky laughter.
What's the difference? It's only a delay till Cooper makes the final break in the circle. There's no way of stopping it. Minutes, hours, days, what's the difference? When the delay is done, there will be no more eternity. Do you hear me? It will be the end of eternity.
Chapter 14. The Earlier Crime.
Why? Why?
Twistle looked helplessly from the gauge to the technician, his eyes mirroring the puzzled frustration in his voice. Harlan lifted his head. He had only one word to say.
Noyes.
Twistle said,
The woman you took into eternity?
Harlan smiled bitterly, said nothing. Twistle said,
What has she to do with this? Great time, I don't understand, boy.
What is there to understand? Harlan burned with sorrow. Why do you pretend ignorance? I had a woman. I was happy, and so was she. We harmed no one. She did not exist in the new reality. What difference would it have made to anyone? Twistle tried vainly to interrupt. Harlan shouted,
But there are rules in eternity, aren't there? I know them all. Liaisons require permission. Liaisons require computations. Liaisons require status. Liaisons are tricky things. What were you planning for Noyes when all this was over? A seat in a crashing rocket? Or a more comfortable position as community mistress for worthy computers? You won't make any plans now, I think.
He ended in a kind of despair, and Twistle moved quickly to the communiplate. Its function as a transmitter had obviously been restored. The computer shouted into it till he aroused an answer. Then he said,
This is Twistle. No one is to be allowed in here. No one. No one. Do you understand? Then see to it. It goes for members of the All-When Council. It goes for them particularly.
He turned back to Harlan, saying abstractedly,
They'll do it because I'm old and senior member of the council and because they think I'm cranky and queer. They give in to me because I'm cranky and queer.
For a moment, he fell into a ruminative silence. Then he said,
Do you think I'm queer?
And his face turned swiftly up to Harlan's like that of a seamed monkey. Harlan thought,
Great time, the man's mad.
The shock has driven him mad. He took a step backward, automatically aghast at being trapped with a madman. Then he steadied. The man,
be he ever so mad, was feeble, and even madness would end soon. Soon? Why not at once? What delayed the end of eternity? Twistle said he had no cigarette in his fingers. His hand made no move to take one, in a quiet, insinuating voice.
You haven't answered me. Do you think I'm queer?
I suppose you do. Too queer to talk to.
If you had thought of me as a friend instead of as a crotchety old man, whimsical and unpredictable, you would have spoken openly to me of your doubts. You would have taken no such action as you did.
Harlan frowned. The man thought Harlan was mad, that was it. He said angrily,
My action was the right one, I'm quite sane.
Twistle said,
I told you the girl was in no danger, you know.
I was a fool to believe that even for a while. I was a fool to believe the council would be just to a technician.
Who told you the council knew any of this?
Finge knew of it, and sent in a report concerning it to the council.
And how do you know that?
I got it out of Finge at the point of a neuronic whip. The business end of a whip abolishes comparative status.
The same whip that did this.
Twistle pointed to the gauge with its blob of molten metal perched, wryly, above the face of the dial.
Yes.
A busy whip.
Then sharply.
Do you know why Finge took it to the council instead of handling the matter himself?
Because he hated me, and wanted to make certain I lost all status. He wanted Noyes.
Twistle said, You're naive. If he had wanted the girl, he could easily have arranged liaison. A technician would not have been in the way. The man hated me, boy.
Still no cigarette. He looked odd without one, and the stained finger he laid on his chest as he spoke the last pronoun looked almost indecently bare.
You? There's such a thing, boy, as council politics. Not every computer is appointed to the council. Finge wanted an appointment. Finge is ambitious and wanted it badly. I blocked it because I thought him emotionally unstable. Time! I never fully appreciated how right I was. Look, boy, he knew you were a protege of mine. He had seen me take you out of a job as an observer and make you a master technician. He saw you working for me steadily. How better could he get back at me and destroy my influence? If he could prove my pet technician guilty of a terrible crime against eternity, it would reflect on me. It might force my resignation from the All-Wen Council, and who do you suppose would then be a logical successor?
His empty hands moved to his lips, and when nothing happened, he looked at the space between finger and thumb blankly. Harlan thought, he's not as calm as he's trying to sound. He can't be.
But why does he talk all this nonsense now, with eternity ending?
Then, in agony,
but why doesn't it end then, now?
Twistle said,
When I allowed you to go to Finge just recently, I more than half suspected danger. But Melanson's memoir said you were away the last month, and no other natural reason for your absence offered itself. Fortunately, Finge underplayed his hand.
In what way? Asked Harlan wearily. He didn't really care, but Twistle talked and talked, and it was easier to take part than to try to shut the sound out of his ears.
Twistle said, Finge labeled his report, In re unprofessional conduct of technician Andrew Harlan. He was being the faithful eternal, you see, being cool, impartial, unexcited. He was leaving it to the council to rage and throw itself at me. Unfortunately for himself, he did not know of your real importance. He did not realize that any report concerning you would be instantly referred to me unless its supreme importance were made perfectly clear on the very face of things.
You never spoke to me of this.
How could I? I was afraid to do anything that would disturb you with the crisis of the project at hand. I gave you every opportunity to bring your problem to me.
Every opportunity? Harlan's mouth twisted in disbelief, but then he thought of Twistle's weary face on the communiplate, asking him if he had nothing to say to him. That was yesterday. Only yesterday.
Harlan shook his head, but turned his face away now. Twissel said softly,
I realized at once that he had deliberately goaded you into your rash action.
Harlan looked up.
You know that? Does that surprise you? I knew Finge was after my neck. I've known it for a long time. I'm an old man, boy. I know these things. But there are ways in which doubtful computers can be checked upon. There are some protective devices, culled out of time, that are not placed in the museums. There are some that are known to the Council alone.
Harlan thought bitterly of the time block at the 100,000th.
From the report, and from what I knew independently, it was easy to deduce what must have happened.
Harlan asked suddenly, I suppose Finge suspected you of spying?
He might have. I wouldn't be surprised.
Harlan thought back to his first days with Finge, when Twissel first showed his abnormal interest in the young observer. Finge had known nothing of the Melanson project, and he had been interested in Twissel's interference.
Have you ever met Senior Computer Twissel?
He had once asked, and thinking back, Harlan could recall the exact tone of sharp uneasiness in the man's voice. As early as that, Finge must have suspected Harlan of being Twissel's finger man. His enmity and hate must have begun that early. Twissel was speaking.
So if you had come to me...
Come to you? Cried Harlan. What of the Council?
Of the entire Council. Only I know.
You never told them. Harlan tried to be mocking.
I never did.